Thank you for listening to a message from the Manhattan Church of Christ. The following sermon was recorded during our Sunday morning worship service. The notes for this sermon are available on our website at www.manhattanchurch.org/sermon-notes. We hope that this message will be helpful to you and encourage you to explore the Word of God. And now, this week's message.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. Another joyous day of hearing the Word, hugging each other, and partaking communion. The Word from today is from Luke 22, 54 through 71. When the guards sees Jesus, they led him to the courtyard of the high priest's mansion. But Peter was following at a distance. There, they kindled a fire in the middle of the atrium and sat down together. And Peter went and sat among them. But when a servant woman saw him sitting in the firelight and got a good look at him, she said, "This fellow was also with him." But he denied, saying, "I don't know him, woman." And after a little while, another person noticed him and said, You are also from that group." But Peter said, "No, I am not, man." Then, when about an hour passed, still another began insisting, saying, "It must be true. This fellow was with him, since he's clearly from Galilee." But Peter said, "I don't know what you're talking about, man." And at that moment, as those words came from his mouth, a rooster crowed. And the Lord turned around and looked directly at Peter. Then Peter remembered the Lord's word, how he told him, "Before the rooster crows today, you're going to deny me three times." Then Peter left and went outside, and he cried bitterly. Now the men who were holding Jesus in bonds started mocking him as they beat him. For example, they blindfolded him and started questioning him, saying, "Prophesy, who's the one who struck you?" And with many other insults of blasphemy, they kept reviling Jesus. When daylight broke, the council of elders for the people, both chief priests and scribes, were assembled. And they led Jesus out from the high priest's house to their Sanhedrin hall in the temple. They demanded, If you yourself are the Messiah, tell us." But he said to them, "If I tell you, you certainly won't believe. But if I ask you questions, you certainly won't answer. Still, from now on, the Son of Man is going to be sitting at the right hand of the power of God." Then they all said, "So you yourself are the Son of God?" But he said to them, "You yourselves are saying that I am." Then they said, "Why do we need any more testimony? For we ourselves heard it from his own mouth." Amen.
I want to thank all of you for being here. If you have not gotten already a copy of the notes for the message today, you can hold up your hand and someone will bring forward a copy for you. And it's a fairly long text, and we're going to be talking about that. I especially this morning, as has already been announced, I want to welcome Dr. Ellen Clark Clameau, who is with us this morning and is going to be here this afternoon talking to our FRGJ group on the I hope much expanded group on the fourth floor with luncheon and all of that. Dr. Clameau you know, sort of read down about things. And she and I share an alumni relationship, namely, with both of us graduated from Princeton Theological Seminary. She teaches there also. I don't do that anymore, and never did teach at Princeton, but taught at Union Theological Seminary, and so on. So it is, but it's great to have her, have someone who is both a pastor and a lawyer, and makes her, at least a part of her life and ministry, that of helping churches deal with things that they may not be familiar with in these difficult and challenging challenging times. And we really want to welcome her and thank her for being willing to help us in that. As I told her, the Ministry of Community of Hope is just such an important part of our life together here. And we want to do things well. We want to do things in a way that is genuinely spiritual and genuinely loving toward the people that we strive to serve. As you're thinking about the close of the sermon today and the service today, in your song book booklet, if you have one, you may want to notice that we're going to be singing "Christ Above Me" again, and so I just be ready for that as we go along. We're in a long series on the Gospel of Luke, and it so happens that here we're coming to the last chapters of the Gospel of Luke, right as we're heading into the period of Holy Week, the time of Palm Sunday and then Easter and all of that. And we're in Luke's narrative, and in these we're within a day of the of Jesus' crucifixion and meeting with his disciples. We've talked about his the Passover meal that he had with his disciples. And Luke, as you perhaps remember and have looked at it yourself, Luke takes us through a very challenging evening there in Jesus' life and the life of the disciples as they have that Passover together. It's in an upper room there in Jerusalem, someplace, we don't know. And it is just full of tradition, where everybody sort of knows exactly what's going to happen in a Passover meal. And then just all kinds of surprises as Jesus says, "I'm not going to do this." And does not always explain exactly why he's doing this, but it's the kingdom of God is breaking in. And so it is this challenging evening. And not only that, but he also looks at this wonderful group of disciples gathered there with him and says that one of them is going to be the one that hands him over to the authorities, that betrays him, as it's usually translated in those kinds of contexts. And as he goes along, he also, there's not an extensive amount about it, but he also looks at Peter and talks about his denial. That's part of our reading for today. And then they go out to the Mount of Olives, as Luke describes it, and we hear of Jesus' prayer to the Father that the cup may pass from him and all of that. And suddenly there on that spot that Jesus was familiar with, there comes a big crowd of people that are ready to arrest Jesus. And evidently it's something that they come armed and dangerous, so to speak, to take him away. Judas is among them. The other disciples evidently were not even aware that Judas had gone away. But he's leading them, attempts to kiss Jesus. Jesus says, "Are you trying to use a kiss to betray me, to hand me over to the others?" And so it happens that they do arrest him. As that happens, some of them know that they've got to get Jesus out of here, and one pulls out a sword. In the Gospel of John, we're told that it was Peter that did it, but in the Gospel of Luke, it just says a particular one of them. One of them pulled out a sword and struck one of the servants of the high priest, cut off his ear. Whew! That was a dangerous thing to do if you've got a whole crowd of official people that are armed and dangerous, and you pick out a sword and start to take on the whole group. But Jesus says, "No, put away the sword." And it doesn't actually say that he picked up the ear, or maybe he just boom. I don't know. He simply touched it and healed it, as Luke tells us. And so, as we go through this, there's just so much happening so quickly and so much to think about. What actually is happening in all of this? Just before all of this, Luke had described how Jesus had been teaching in the temple there, in the temple courts for a while, and he got up early in the morning and would come in there. And he got to where the people in Jerusalem got up even earlier so they could get there and get spots to listen to him. And so he sits in the temple courts where there were these huge, beautiful colonnades. And you could stay out of the sun. And Jesus teaches them, and the crowds are there. And basically, the crowds work like a wall of protection around Jesus, because they are certain that Jesus is a prophet, and so on. Big crowds, evidently, at least as Luke describes them. But there's not a word about Jesus saying, "Oh, we've got a lot of people on our side. Let's get them organized. Let's get them prepared for some opposition and how we're going to deal with it when it comes up." He just teaches them. But there's then this moment that we just described of them coming at the people from the temple guard. That were guards, of course, that kept the temple gates and all kinds of things that policed it and so forth. And they were brought out there with the high priest's coterie. And when Judas tries to kiss Jesus, and Jesus sort of verbally pushes him back, still there's, from Jesus, not a bit of resistance. He puts away that one sword. And all of this is going on. I think Luke is suggesting to us, with that sword, that certainly the disciples expected Jesus to resist. They knew that he was powerful beyond belief. And they expect him to back them up if they resist with the sword, but Jesus does not. It all swirls around them as they try to make sense of this. He doesn't react to things the way any ordinary human being ought to react. He doesn't take on this kind of opposition, these things that are clearly unjust, and oppose them powerfully. And so it's part of a kind of question that runs all the way through the gospel that we've hit many times as we've studied the Gospel of Luke. this key question that comes up again and again. What's going on with Jesus? Who does this kind of thing? Who is he? That he acts in this way, that he reacts in this way. What is he really doing? He talks about, he started out his whole ministry talking about the inbreaking of God's kingdom. His disciples came to know him as Messiah, as the anointed king, the Christ, if you were speaking Greek. He was a prophet, certain, but he also could transform one life after another by healing and so forth. Who is he? What does it mean that he's claiming God's kingdom breaking in? Messiah means anointed king. When's he going to be the anointed king? That means he's right in the line of David. He's a descendant of David. Is he going to overthrow the Romans? Is he going to take over the government? What about those priests and all their corruption in the temple that so many people hated? We know, we've seen him. Nothing can stop him if he wants to do something. And so we who watch and listen, we have words to describe all of this. When we talk about Messiah, an anointed king, that has whole sets of meanings for us that we're waiting to see unfold here. We watch, we listen, we have the words, we have the ideas, but Jesus, every time we sort of touch an idea, Jesus seems to change it, to rewrite it, to redo it, to challenge us to think about it in a different way. And as Luke writes this narrative, quite a few years later down the line, he's writing it not for Peter and Andrew and James and John, those disciples, probably most of them already, maybe not all of them, but a high percentage of them by the time Luke writes, have already died for Jesus in one way or another. He's not writing it for their benefit, but for the benefit of those believers who have that time distance. And that means a distance of imagination and understanding. He wants them, he wants us who are just in that same line, but just a lot further down the line. Jesus, Luke wants us to know the vision of Jesus. To be able to hear and to feel and to sense the difference between what the disciples mean when they say Messiah and what Jesus means when he says Messiah. And he wants us to think and feel and understand and worship and serve our way into that so that we can know Jesus in a way that those that vision of Jesus, those words of Jesus become our heart and our lives and who we are. And so one of the ways that he does that through the gospel, and it continues on into the second volume in the book of Acts, is he can't tell everybody's story, so he concentrates on a few. As we're talking about in our small group on Tuesday evening in the book of Acts, he spends quite a bit of time talking about Paul. And you can write a biography of Paul, in at least a partial biography of Paul, from what Luke says about him. But in the gospel, Paul's not around yet, because if he knows about Jesus during Jesus' own lifetime, he definitely does not like him. But one who is there and who has a very important role in the church is Peter. And so he highlights Peter at a number of places along the way, and obviously that Peter's one of the key people in our text for this this morning. He wants us to see the transforming story of Peter, his journey as he learns Jesus. And it's not a quick and easy journey where it just, boom, is all changes completely. It's a considerable process as we go through both the gospel and then well into Acts, still learning more and more about Peter and how he responds to Jesus and knows more and more about him. The way, if you're looking in the Gospel of Mark or the Gospel of Matthew, that Peter gets introduced is Jesus going along the Sea of Galilee, and he simply calls these two brothers, Peter and Andrew, and he calls James and John, and they tells them to follow him. Luke decides not to tell the story that way. He knows a particular part of that process of calling. And he tells it in a vivid way that lets us know sort of where we begin with Peter. I've included it there on the one side of your sheet. I guess it's at the bottom of the front side of your sheet there. And from Luke chapter 5, verses 4 through 11. When Jesus, well, it happens, let me say first, it happens just one day as Jesus is teaching in the synagogue one Sabbath, and after that's over with, he happens to go to, and it's like it's just happenstance, as Luke tells it, he happens to go to Simon's house. And that's all that's named, this Simon, as Luke tells it there right at the beginning of chapter 5. And lo and behold, Simon's mother-in-law is sick, and he heals her. And that's the way we meet Simon. Simon, at least as Luke tells about it, is not yet explicitly a disciple of Jesus. But he receives this view of Jesus, of him healing this woman. And then it says that Jesus had huge crowds coming to be taught. And he was there by the Sea of Galilee. That's where Simon lived with his family. And he goes out to the sea, and he's right up against the water, and the crowds are pushing in on him. And so he gets into a boat there. And as Luke says, and it was Simon's. That's all it says. It doesn't say he asked or anything like that. He gets into a boat, and he asks Simon, would you just put out a little ways from the shore? And so Simon does. He, after all, he's seen Jesus heal his mother-in-law. And so he goes out a little ways from the shore, and there the crowds are on the shore, and Jesus teaches them for a long time. And the text that I've printed there in our sheet is as Jesus finishes the teaching. It doesn't say what he taught, it's just that he taught. When Jesus had finished his teaching, he said to Simon, row out to the deep water and let down your nets for a catch. Simon said, Master, we worked all night and caught nothing. But at your word, it helps that if you've healed their mother-in-law, but at your word, I'll lower the nets. When they did this, they caught such a shoal of fish, the nets started tearing. They waved to their partners in the other boat to come help them. And they filled both boats so full that they were almost going under. Now, when Simon Peter, that's where the name Peter comes in the Gospel of Luke. When Simon Peter saw it, he fell before Jesus, saying, leave me, Lord, because I'm a sinful man. Astonished awe seized him and all those with him, including James and John, sons of Zebedee, Simon's partners. Then Jesus said to Simon, don't be afraid. From now on, you'll be catching people to give life, to keep them alive. And when they landed, I take it as Peter and James and John, maybe Andrew. Andrew's not mentioned in all of this. They let everything go and followed Jesus. Now notice here that Jesus does explicitly call Peter, but it's only after Jesus lets Peter see something. Peter needs to know that something is real. He lets him see the healing of his mother-in-law. He lets him see the crowds there on the shore as he's evidently working on the nets or whatever it is, and Jesus is sitting in one part of the boat and teaching all the people there. And he lets him see that full net that they had not been able to catch anything, and they pull it out, and two boats are nearly sinking from it. He sees it. You might think, oh, wow. He might say, well, I want to get this guy working for me. Yeah, you know, we're going to be the most successful fishing operation on the Sea of Galilee by far. But this is too much. This is uncanny. This can't happen, and yet I've seen it. And so he's afraid. It's clearly not in my control. And he says, leave me, Lord. He started off calling him master, like sort of an expert teacher or something like that. And he ends calling him Lord, like you spoke about God. Leave me, Lord. I'm a sinful man. But Jesus doesn't say, okay, well, you have the right to be who you want to be, and if you don't want me around, I'm not going to impose myself on you. But you have this sense, certainly, I think Luke wants us to have it, that Jesus understands Peter better than Peter understands himself. Jesus refuses Peter's own self-description, that I'm just a sinful man, go away from me, let me be. He has in mind something more. It's not going to be something that's just a magical, boom, I'm going to tap you on the shoulder with my magic wand and you're going to be a different person. No, it's going to be seeing this and seeing that and hearing this and hearing that and knowing yourself more and coming to know me. So as Jesus refuses that self-description, by the time they get on land, both Peter and James and John and their whole fishing enterprise, they leave it all behind. Whew! I wonder what Peter's wife thought about that. You left it behind? You know my mom's sick. How are we going to pay for the doctors? You can imagine. You can make it up, like I'm making it up. He leaves everything behind, and he follows Jesus. Well, we're going to skip over a lot. Let's go over to another passage that's there on your sheet from Luke 9. There's been a lot of experience with Jesus in between here. And we're in Luke chapter 9, verse 20. And Jesus now has 12 apostles, and he has disciples, other disciples. And he takes a batch of them, the 12, up to the north country. And they start talking about who people think Jesus is. It's again that theme that runs all the way through the gospel. Who is Jesus? Jesus asks his disciples Luke 9:20 and following. But you, who do you say that I am? Jesus does not say, listen, sit down over here and get out your notepads and take notes, because I'm going to explain to you who I am so you know who I am and you can answer any questions if it comes up in your conversations. None of that. He asked them, who do you say that I am? And then he waits for the answer. Peter answers, as it turns out, God's Messiah, ho Christos tou Theou, the Christ of God, the anointed King of God. Wow. Just a little ways back, he was saying, Lord, I am a sinful man. Just get away from me, stay away. I can't deal with this kind of change of the world around me. But that's the right answer, as everybody reading the gospel knows. But the amazing thing is the next verb, Jesus rebuked him, rebuked them, all of them. And Jesus, this is verse 21, Jesus ordered them to tell this to no one. Why? Because it was necessary for the Son of Man to suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and scribes. That's a grouping we're going to see in our own text. And be killed. And on the third day be raised. Things that you just can't know. You know, as we have other statements like that, and sometimes Luke will comment and that they didn't understand a word of what Jesus was saying. Then he told everyone, not just his own disciples, if anyone wants to come after me, they must, now notice this word, they must deny. Deny. But deny themselves. And we're going to be dealing with Peter's denial, saying, I don't know him. And what does it mean to deny yourself? Is it to recognize that I don't really know me? I have to understand myself some other way than how I've understood it before. And the way you do that, he says in this amazing statement, when none of the end of the gospel has happened yet, they need to pick up their cross each day. Now, a cross is just about the most awful thing you can talk about. It's the most degrading and humiliating way to die. Pick up their cross each day and keep following me. Jesus asked, who do you say that I am? Peter has that right answer, but Jesus silences it because he knows that what the words mean to Peter and probably to all the other disciples are different from what those words really mean in the life of Jesus. They don't understand themselves. They don't understand Jesus. They've got to see more. They've got to experience more. They've got to pick up that cross. They've got to follow Jesus. Well, just one more step as we're going along here with Peter, that we've talked about recently. And that is at the Last Supper, and we've already mentioned that this morning. Luke 22, verses 31 to 34, also there on your sheet. Jesus has shared with them, let them share the bread and the wine of the Passover meal. And he suddenly says, This is not in any of the other Gospels, but he suddenly looks at Simon and says, Simon, look, the Satan, the accuser, the Satan, has asked to have all of you, to sift like wheat. But I prayed for you that your faith may not fail. So you, when you return, strengthen your brothers and sisters. Now, Peter, might say, well, thank you for your concern about me, Lord, but I really, it's not really a danger for me, because, Lord, with you, I'm prepared to go both to prison and to death. I'm your soldier. I'm your right-hand man. I'm going to be with you no matter what opposition comes against you. Jesus looks at him. I'm telling you, Peter, a rooster won't crow today before you deny that you know me 3 times. Now notice, Jesus chooses to pray specifically for Peter. He's ready for prison. He's ready for death with Jesus. But somehow that very serious commitment and the way in which he thinks of it shows that he doesn't really grasp what Jesus is doing, who he is, what he's about. They aren't comrades in the same platoon of soldiers, so to speak, side by side going into battle. Jesus is going to be doing something that is for Peter, yes, for all of the disciples, yes, but for all the world. He can't go with Jesus side by side, but can he let Jesus go? Does he know who he is? Does he know who Jesus is? Well, just as Jesus foretold in our passage, our passage tells about how when the crisis comes and Jesus is actually arrested in the garden, and the guards sees him, and they take him to the high priest's mansion or palace, where he has a big place, evidently one of the larger places in the city. And I don't know whether you've ever seen pictures of how houses were constructed in Jerusalem, but almost all over the Mediterranean world. They all, any substantial house by an important person or a fairly wealthy person, sort of like a fortress. You walk up to it, you don't have a white picket fence and a lawn and everything, and walk up and, drop off your Amazon package there or whatever, anything like that. They're a wall to the road. They're, a couple of feet back from the road, so it's just a little ways of walking there, but it's a wall, solid wall, with a gate, and you go through the gate inside, and then there's a big atrium or big open air courtyard there. And depending on how wealthy you are, it determines how big that is. And a lot of them had, for more medium-sized houses, had roofs that would flow down to the center, and the rainwater would run down into a cistern, and that was one of the ways you got water and all of those kinds of things. So, in Luke 22:54, it describes this. They take Jesus off when they seize Jesus, take him off to the high priest's mansion. But Peter was following at a distance. Luke takes note of that. But notice when it goes in, there they kindled a fire in the middle of that atrium and sat down. The high priest has evidently, you know, gone to bed or whatever. I don't know exactly what was going on with him, but and others there too. But the guards are out there, and they have Jesus, and Peter's there too, and there doesn't seem to be much of any threat for him here. Peter goes and sits down among them and so forth. But then there's this servant woman who saw him sitting there in the firelight and got a good look at him. And she said, this fellow was also with him. But he denied. I don't know him, woman. Oh, but it's so humiliating to have to say that to a slave woman. After a little while, another person noticed him and said, you are also from that group. Peter said, no, I'm not, man. Then when about an hour passed, there wasn't much danger here. He could sit there for an hour. Still another began insisting, saying, it must be true. This fellow was with him since he's clearly from Galilee. He's a Galilean. And Peter said, I don't know what you're talking about, man. And at that moment, Luke says, as those words were coming from his mouth, a rooster crowed. And the Lord, notice this, the Lord hasn't gone inside into some place that's going to be the court room for him. He's standing right there in that same courtyard. The Lord turned around and looked directly at Peter. Then Peter remembered the Lord's word, how he told him, before a rooster crows today, you're going to deny me three times. Then Peter left and went outside, and he cried bitterly. Kind of our first instinct, and I think it's the instinct that kind of gets baked into the story, is that, wow, isn't it amazing how Peter's bravado turns into cowardice? But I'm not sure there's any real cowardice here. There's not a danger that Peter is facing. He gets met by a slave woman who doesn't say, I'm reporting you to the guards right this minute, and they're going to arrest you. And he doesn't have some Roman soldier that comes up with his sword to his neck and says, deny Jesus or I'll slice off your head. So he can stand up and say, do whatever you want. I will always be faithful to Jesus. No, it's the slave woman who doesn't do anything. There's no heroic confrontation. There's no chance. What I think probably caused Peter to want to go in there in the first place is maybe there might be some way of getting Jesus out of their clutches so we can rally people and Jesus can still become king, even though they've arrested him for the moment. Jesus is right there. Jesus can do anything, but he isn't signaling any plan. So Peter hides his identity. He doesn't, at least as the story unfolds, as Luke tells it, he doesn't seem to have any sense of having done anything wrong. He's just staying undercover. But there's no Jesus with him. He's off over there. Jesus knows Peter, but Peter doesn't know himself. And actually, he doesn't really know who Jesus is either. It's so hard to let go of his own heroic story. Three times he hides his identity. Three times he denies himself, denies his own identity. But then when Jesus turns around and looks directly at him, I think Luke wants us to realize that Peter sees himself in Jesus' gaze. He's in there probably to try to get Jesus out. But Jesus is not eligible for saving. He can't save Jesus and make him king. He can't fit Jesus into his own heroic story. He has to let Jesus go and simply follow him. I don't know what he saw, of course, when Jesus looked him right in the eye and he saw Jesus. I know he went out and he cried and cried bitterly. My own imagination is that he realized that he didn't know Jesus. When he said to the woman, "I don't know him, lady. I don't know him, you servant," or whatever. He thought he was lying, but he was speaking the truth. He didn't know Jesus. He realized that he had wanted to have Jesus as part of the story that would be great, in which he could save him and make him king. And so he weeps and weeps and weeps. It's a crucial turning. Now, Luke carries the story of Peter on, and as you go off the end of the Gospel of Luke, the next time you see Peter in a really big way, it's on the day of Pentecost. And it's as a missionary going out into the world. But it's also dealing, do you remember, with Cornelius, a Gentile? And Peter has to break the whole pattern of his life to go to a Gentile's house. Luke shows that Peter still has much to learn, but he, as Jesus said, is able to strengthen others. Well, I'm sorry, we've gone way past our time here, so I just want very quickly to summarize the last verses here. Jesus, Peter at least though, is able to come back and minister to the others. Jesus is still there though. And if Peter only learns Jesus with difficulty and with many missteps, what about the others? What about us? Luke isn't going to give us a nice formula about Jesus to memorize. People like me, like you, we have to see, we have to perceive with our own eyes, with our own hearts. You first have the little story of the guards that are just standing there, and they've got Jesus tied up, and they start beating him. But, oh, that's fun, but you get tired of beating somebody, don't you? You know, whenever you beat somebody, don't you get tired? Yeah. They beat him. Let's have a little more fun. They put a bag over his head so he can't see, and they start beating him. Ah, let's do this. He says he's a prophet. Let's make him prophesy. Tell who it is that's beating him. That'll be fun. They blaspheme him and revile him. But then when daylight comes, more serious people come on the scene. The council of elders for the people, the chief priests, the scribes. We're looking at Luke 22, 66 and following there on your text. They're all assembled. And they take Jesus from the house of the high priest and they go to the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin had a room there in the temple itself, and that's where they go. And they demand of him one question: who are you? If you yourself are the Messiah, the Christos, the anointed king, tell us. But he said to them, Jesus has been questioned by these people before. Remember when they wanted to know by what authority you're doing these things. And he said, I want to know from you, but what about John's baptism? The baptism of John the Baptist, was that from heaven or from human beings? And they couldn't bring themselves to answer. And so Jesus says, it's just like that. If I tell you, you certainly won't believe. But if I ask you questions, you certainly won't answer. But as Luke describes it here, he gives a brief statement by Jesus, but that has about as many scriptural allusions and references as you can jam into a single sentence. Still, from now on, the Son of Man, that's Daniel 7, 13 and 14, a great vision of the Son of one like a Son of Man who comes to God, to the Ancient of Days, and receives a kingdom over all the earth that will never end. The Son of Man is going to be sitting at the right hand of the power of God. Oh, Psalm 110, verse 1, it's the most quoted verse from the Old Testament and all of the New Testament. Sitting at that right hand, it's the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies a footstool under your feet. So Jesus just puts those together, and so he's got the Psalm, he's got Daniel, he's got references in that, because that one that's David's Lord means that he's the descendant of David. Jesus had asked about that. That means he's the one that God is going to be with as the son of David. That means that God says, I will consider him my son. And so that makes him the Son of God. And so that's the way they respond. They're looking for an accusation. They all say, so you yourself are the Son of God. That's from being the Son of David. 2 Samuel 7:14. But he says to them, you yourselves are saying that I am. Ego eimi. Greek, that's the name of God from Exodus. Then they said, why do we need any more testimony? We've heard, we ourselves heard it from his own mouth. The more sophisticated Sanhedrin they're looking for charges to bring against Jesus. Messiah, anointed king, tell us. Jesus knows it's useless to answer them. Jesus, though, as Luke describes, it takes us, if we're open to sort of going in with him into the scriptures, that's where this story reaches back. That's where the roots of all of it are. Takes us into the depths of scripture, David and Daniel and Exodus. Jesus is indeed Son of Man. He's receiving God's kingdom as Son of David, Son of God. All this is happening, whether the court understands or not, because this is the announcement of what God is doing. Luke helps us by letting us have a glimpse into that place there in the Sanhedrin. Maybe Jesus had told them about what all happened at that time. And by helping us through Peter to see how it was difficult to put these things together, he helps us with Peter to take our own vision of how it must happen out of the story, our own pictures of whatever our particular vision is, so that we can receive that announcement of what God is doing. We can receive that kingdom, that message as a gift of God's grace to us. And it says to us, like to Peter, when you return, strengthen your brothers and sisters. Christ before me, Christ behind me. Let's sing together as we conclude our time together this morning.